It's the takeaway for Wednesday, September 11th. I'm Tanzina Vega. Top colleges make huge profits off of their student athletes, and the players have been expected to train and play without compensation. The California law is trying to change that.
We do have hungry nights that we don't have enough money to get food, and sometimes, you know, money is needed.
It's a very self-interested and really cynical effort, I think, to continue a process that has limited athletes' real rights.
The opportunity to go to college, given the fact that most of those kids are never going to be professional athletes, is an incredible investment in their futures.
The idea that they should, you know, be satisfied with a scholarship when they're worth so much more, and which they're making the coaches like Nick Saban $10, $11, $12 million is ridiculous.
But first, the demand for accountability for the U.S. opioid crisis. The United States continues to struggle with opioid addiction. Nationwide, more than 130 people die every day from an opioid overdose. And now states across the country are holding manufacturers and distributors of opioids accountable for their role in creating what they say is an epidemic. Last month, Johnson & Johnson was ordered to pay $572 million in Oklahoma, which pursued the first civil case against the drug manufacturer for causing opioid-related deaths. In October, some of the country's largest drug manufacturers and distributors will face trial in a major consolidated lawsuit made up of some 2,000 cases from municipalities across the country. The Sackler family, owners of Purdue Pharma, which make OxyContin, is in settlement talks and could be on the brink of filing for bankruptcy. And now, in the lead-up to the October trial, new reporting shows that as early as 2001, Johnson & Johnson were aware of how addictive their fentanyl patches actually were. Joining us now is Dr. Rebecca Haffagy, content lead for opioid policy at the University of Michigan Injury Prevention Center. Rebecca, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by Julia Lurie, senior reporter at Mother Jones. Julia, thanks for being with The Takeaway.
Thank you.
We'll start with you, Julia. The first state lawsuit, against Johnson & Johnson in Oklahoma was just a couple weeks ago. How significant was that?
It was significant in setting the tone for how future cases like this could go. So that was the first of these types of lawsuits to go to trial. And the judge effectively found Johnson & Johnson liable for helping fuel this crisis in the state of Oklahoma. The money that the state is getting as a result, the $572 million, will go towards things like addiction treatment and other services in the state of Oklahoma. And it's what the state estimates would cover about a year of services to mitigate this crisis in Oklahoma. It's way less than the $17 billion that the state was originally requesting, but still it's not nothing. And as we go into this fall with this federal case on the horizon, people are definitely speculating that the plaintiffs in this federal case will use similar arguments to the arguments that were used in Oklahoma.
So let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, what was Johnson & Johnson's argument in Oklahoma, and how do we expect them to argue here in this next lawsuit?
The state alleged that Johnson & Johnson's role basically falls into two different categories. So the first is that, like many other pharmaceutical companies, Johnson & Johnson underplayed the addictive effects of its own opioids that it sold, and really heavily marketed those drugs to high-volume prescribers and overplayed the benefits of its drugs. The other allegations are more unique to Johnson & Johnson. So Johnson & Johnson, what a lot of people don't know, is that they were key players in the opioid supply chain. So a subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson was responsible for growing poppies in Tasmania and selling narcotics to leading drug companies, including OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma, for example. The state of Oklahoma was basically saying, you caused a public nuisance in this state by not only fueling these other drug companies, but by selling your own opioids, and you need to pay for that.
Rebecca, there is, as we mentioned, that major consolidated lawsuit going to trial in Ohio in October. How many companies are going to be involved? What are the basics here?
Yeah, so there's many companies involved, both distributors and manufacturers, and there's two plaintiffs, the counties, Cuyahoga and Summit counties of Ohio. So there are multiple claims being brought, unlike the Oklahoma trial, which really did whittle down to just what Julia had mentioned, the public nuisance claim. The trial in Ohio has both that, it has general fraud claims, it has other sort of claims under the Controlled Substances Act, the federal law. So that can bring in federal claims as well, because that is a federal trial. So it's there's much more complexity going on there and many other ways that the various defendants could be held liable.
And we know that we've done reporting on this show about the opioid crisis in Ohio. How significant is it that this is happening in Ohio, Rebecca?
Quite significant. I mean, that's really why the multi-district litigation was consolidated there, in large part because it's the epicenter of the opioid crisis. Ohio, you know, is among the worst states, you know, depending on what year you're looking at or what measure, but among the worst states in terms of opioid harms, and really only has started those harms. The prescribing only crested in Ohio very recently, and I believe the deaths are still increasing or flat. So it's one of the worst states. So that was one reason why the trial and the overall federal litigation was consolidated there.
Julia, as we mentioned, the Sackler family, who are the owners of Purdue Pharma, who make OxyContin, are and other companies are trying to settle the case before actually going to court in October. Tell us a little bit about that strategy.
Sure. So any given defendant could settle or they could go to trial. A couple of the pharmaceutical companies have already have official settlement agreements on the table, and there's been talk of a Purdue settlement as well. You know, on the one hand, with a settlement, the argument is that municipalities could get money faster. The whole point of this litigation is to help mitigate the effects of the crisis. So theoretically, the municipalities want to be getting money as fast as they can so that they can then, you know, apply it locally to what they need to do to deal with this crisis. And theoretically, they wouldn't have to deal with this long, drawn-out legal process that comes with a trial. On the other hand, with settlements, you could argue that there would be a lack of transparency, that the evidence that, you know, would look really bad for pharmaceutical companies and distributors and pharmacies wouldn't end up coming out. With just some of the exhibits so far, and this is before the case has even gone to trial, you're seeing things like internal emails and sales presentation and sales numbers and donations to various pain advocacy organizations that really sort of tell the story of how this opioid crisis came to be. And with a settlement, you likely wouldn't see the complexity and the complete picture of that story.
Rebecca, how useful is the approach here of taking these companies to court and that in terms of really having an impact on the crisis, the opioid crisis across the country?
Yeah, so I believe it's a supplement to other policies. I don't think it's entirely futile. And the reason being, some of what Julia was saying, it can actually serve to bring forth important evidence so we understand how the crisis evolved, you know, how different parties might have been responsible. It serves as a deterrent as well, so that these companies and others like them, and even in other drug spaces, are deterred from engaging in some of these behaviors in the future, you know, if indeed they did fraudulently market their products, misrepresent their product's addictiveness, deliberately manipulate those aspects of opioids. So if they indeed did that, and it, you know, is looking like many did based upon the evidence that's coming forward, then we have that on the record. We have some evidence of that. We have some accountability. We have some deterrent from that happening in the future. It also, you know, the damages can, you know, I think they are starting to, and they could add up to significant amounts of money. And the fact of the matter is, you know, the federal government has given, you know, a couple billion at this point, but not anywhere near what the costs of mitigating the crisis are. And states and localities, the reason they're bringing these lawsuits is they are out of money. They do not have the money anymore to be putting towards naloxone, EMT, EMS services, treatment, all of these things that are needed to now try to, you know, repair all of the harms.
Julia, off of that point, I mean, first of all, is the money, we mentioned the Oklahoma settlement, I don't know if that's, I guess, putting in quotes here, enough to fill some of the gaps that exist right now in terms of what's needed and what actually, where the funding is. And also, who is going to oversee this money to make sure it is going to the places that it's really needed?
Yeah, as Rebecca mentioned, you know, the largely, you know, broadly speaking, the reason why these municipalities are suing, why these 2,000 some municipalities are suing, is because this crisis has not only been really devastating, but very expensive. So, you know, counties, for example, they have to foot the costs of emergency medical services and addiction treatment and foster care for kids and court and prison costs for drug users and dealers. This is an incredibly costly crisis. And so, you know, it's hard to say how much money would be enough money. In the case of the Johnson & Johnson case in Oklahoma, the state had been asking for $17 billion to cover all those costs, and that would cover those costs theoretically for the next 20 years. They ended up coming out with about a year's worth of money to cover the costs of the crisis.
Rebecca, have we heard anything from the 2020 Democratic candidates about their plan for this issue and just the broader issue of opioid addiction in the United States?
Yeah, so the most prominent proposal would be that the CARE Act, which has been proposed, was proposed in 2018 by Senator Warren and Eli Cummings, and Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris have also come out in support of that bill. So that bill would put, to my earlier point of we really don't have the money, and even the federal government hasn't put the appropriate or adequate amounts forward. This bill would get closer to where we need to be. So that the bill would put $100 billion over 10 years towards the opioid crisis, largely in terms of addiction treatment, but also other social supports. And that's more along the line of what most estimates nationally say the crisis is costing. It's a lot more. It's more like you know, $100 billion per year are some of the, you know, estimates. It depends on what you include in the cost. But at least that bill would get us quite a bit closer to the magnitude of money we need.
Dr. Rebecca Haffagy is content lead for opioid policy at the University of Michigan Injury Prevention Center. And Julia Lurie is a senior reporter at Mother Jones. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Another side of the opioid crisis is happening in jails and prisons across the country, and it gets a lot less attention than national efforts to hold drug makers accountable. The standard of care to treat opioid use disorder is called medication-assisted treatment, or MAT, and that can include drugs like methadone. But less than 1% of jails and prisons across the country provide their incarcerated population with treatment. For many, that lack of care means inmates can experience painful and sudden withdrawal and then face a much higher chance of overdosing and dying after they're released. Deanna King is a policy manager at the Drug Policy Alliance, and I asked her what happens when someone addicted to opioids gets to an average correctional facility.
It depends on where you're incarcerated. We could talk about the Keep Rikers program. When you go into that space, you are screened for substance use disorder. If you do have an opioid dependency, you're placed into the Keep program where you're medically detoxed and then placed on an MAT program based on your needs. And that program's been in existence for over 3 decades. And that's the best case scenario. You're still incarcerated. If you are in a facility that doesn't have access to these medications, you're not giving any medical detox. What they're likely to do is give you medications to treat the symptoms. So you'll be given Tylenol or Pepto-Bismol to deal with the nausea, but you are forced to go through a really heinous withdrawal process in a space that's already egregious when it comes to providing medical care. So you're in a cell. Sometimes they'll place you in solitary if you become disruptive. And being disruptive in this context is just displaying physical signs of discomfort and illness. So they can put you in isolation where you're forced to go through this withdrawal without any support.
What about federal regulations? I mean, are there any federal regulations around opioid addiction treatment inside jails and prisons?
So when I first started looking into this issue, I did not know how restrictive OTP regulations are.
And what are OTP regulations?
So opioid treatment programs. These are the spaces that can provide methadone in a community setting. They're the methadone clinics that we have that we see in our communities. My assumption was that you can just get the medication and provide it in this facility, but that's not the case. Because federal regulation demands that you have to have certain structures created in the facility in order to prescribe this medication. You need to have safes. You need to have, like, proper security. It's overly burdensome. So it imposes this cost on the facilities that they would not incur if it was just, like, a deregulated medication.
Now, what happens if inmates don't get the correct treatment that they need? I know you said some of them could be put in solitary confinement, but that's at the intake stage, mm-hmm. right? What happens in the long term if these inmates don't get any type of adequate treatment for their addictions?
So the rates of fatal overdose in this population is enormously high. The number that's most reported is people who have justice involvement are 40 times more likely to overdose in the 2 weeks following release. So we're seeing these egregious overdose rates because when you are incarcerated and you're not given access to maintenance therapy in the form of MAT, and if you don't continue to use while you're inside, your tolerance is going to decrease. And if you decide to go back into the community and use again and use at the same rate, your likelihood of overdosing is much higher.
What about Rhode Island? They've been doing some interesting treatment options there. Tell us a little bit about that.
So Rhode Island, I think, was one of the first states in the nation. They allow the use of all forms of medication-assisted treatment. So you have methadone and buprenorphine and Vivitrol if that person wants it. So that there's no breakdown in treatment. And that continuum of care is really important because if you have that gap in care and you return to use, that's when we can lose people.
I mean, there are some people who probably ask, well, why is it the responsibility of a jail or a prison to provide this type of treatment?
Well, prisons and jails are responsible for providing medical care to people that they are detaining. Like, these medications are not a specialty form of medication. It's an essential component of medical care. So I want to start there. And they have a responsibility to this population. If we're going to continue to criminalize substance use, then you need to be able to provide the methods of care in that space.
So earlier this year, New York was considering a bill which, if it passed, would require all state prisons and correctional facilities to offer medication to inmates who were suffering from opioid use disorder. What happened there?
So we worked on this bill for the past 2 years or so because we wanted to address what was happening in the counties as well what was happening in the state correctional department. We advocated for the bill really aggressively. We had a lot of allies join, and we were able to get it passed in the Senate. But unfortunately, it stalled in the assembly and did not pass before the session came to a close.
What do you think is the holdup here? I mean, the opioid crisis in particular has gotten so much attention. The companies that manufacture these drugs have now been held to judicial standards. They've been sued, and they've had to pay significant funds for that. So what's the holdup?
Unfortunately, we still have a lot of people who aren't aware of what these medications are. And these people have positions of power to dictate what happens in these facilities. So prior to the end of session, the New York State Sheriff's Association released the opposition memo against the bill saying that they consider buprenorphine to be contraband. And we know of people who have brought in buprenorphine to their people who are incarcerated because it's a medication that's necessary. And if the county jails aren't providing it, then people are taking this risk of bringing it inside to their families. If you made it accessible and created a program, you would have control over how this medication is dispensed. We also had a memo opposition that was put forward by the Council of Mental Hygiene Directors. They saw it as something that was overburdensome for the counties as far as the fiscal impact, and it was also an infrastructure issue for them because some counties lack methadone facilities. They have a lack of physicians who prescribe these medications. And instead of working with us to address those really real barriers, they made an assumption that there are going to be 150 people in every county jail who would use medications at this rate. So 50 people on methadone, 50 people on buprenorphine, 50 people on Vivitrol, which is really expensive. And then they multiplied that number together and came up with $15 million. And then they put forward that number in the assembly, which was entirely made up, and that was enough to scare some people in the budget department. We were able to push back against that because we were working with a sheriff out in Albany who has been doing this program since January 2019, Sheriff Apple, and he's been able to treat up to 120 people, and I think he estimated that his program cost $45,000 for that 6 months. If people are rhetorically putting forth all these statements about how much they want to end this crisis, they need to be willing to invest in the solutions that are effective.
Deanna King is a policy manager at the Drug Policy Alliance. Deanna, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
College sports are a booming business. Division I schools like the University of Texas and The Ohio State University rake in hundreds of millions of dollars off of their athletic programs, from television rights to merchandising, concessions, and other money streams. But student athletes don't share in those profits. Here's basketball player Shabazz Napier speaking in 2014 before winning an NCAA championship with UConn.
We're definitely best to get a scholarship to our universities, but at the end of the day, that doesn't cover everything. We do have hungry nights that we don't have enough money to get food, and sometimes, money is needed.
Now, California legislators are trying to change the economics of college sports in their state with the Fair Pay to Play Act. If signed into law, the bill would go into effect in 2023 and give college athletes in California the right to receive money from endorsements and likeness rights. Versions of the bill have already passed in California's State Assembly and Senate. Joining me now to discuss is Andy Schwartz, an antitrust economist specializing in sports economics, who consulted on the Fair Pay to Play Act. And he's also the founder of the Historical Basketball League, the first professional college basketball league. Andy, thanks for being with The Takeaway.
Well, thank you for having me on.
So you consulted on the writing of this bill. How exactly will the Fair Pay to Play Act allow students to make money?
The idea is that what the NCAA does when it gets all of its schools together and agrees not to allow athletes to receive third-party payments is that's an economic cartel. And what the California bill essentially says is it doesn't say anyone has to pay anyone, but it says it's against California law to prevent that from happening.
I'm going to imagine the response from the NCAA has not been a positive one, but how have they responded so far? And do they actually have the ability to prevent California-based teams from participating?
The official NCAA reaction was that Mark Emmert, who's the president of the organization and who is paid around $2 million, sent a sternly worded letter threatening that if California schools were forced to follow California law, that the NCAA would not allow them to compete in national championships. Schools themselves have said softer things like, gosh, we really want to follow California law, but the big bad bully in Indianapolis won't let us.
Let's take a step back here. I mean, what are the economics for these college students? We heard at the top here, sometimes, the athletes have hungry nights. These athletes are coming in often with scholarships. What do the economics look like for these athletes?
I feel like there's a step you need to take before asking about the economics, which is what are the rights? And if you come into this with the presumption that athletes are full citizens, like Shabazz Napier was right. He was both blessed to get a scholarship, and he was also being exploited by not getting his full value. And that's an important economic difference. College athletes, especially elite college athletes, are worth far more than the NCAA cap. They can get a full scholarship. In the last 5 years or so, they can now get cash payments of about $5,000. and they can get $0 on top of that for their name, image, and likeness. And essentially what this bill is getting at and what the general idea is that unless an athlete's name, image, and likeness rights are worth zero, capping it at zero is exploitive.
We talked a little bit about the NCAA response, but there are colleges like USC, Stanford, and the University of California system that have come out against the law, particularly over concerns that California teams will end up being barred by national competitions. What's your response to some of their concerns?
Well, I'm a proud Stanford graduate, but on this one, Stanford is really shaming me in the sense that universities in California should be all for empowering Californians to be entrepreneurial and to maximize their potential. And what the schools here are essentially doing is agreeing with a system that's exploitive. It's a very self-interested and really cynical effort, I think, to continue a process that has limited athletes' real rights.
Do you expect the NCAA to appeal to the courts? I mean, how might they argue their case here?
Yeah, so I'm an economist, not a lawyer, but I like to play a lawyer on the radio anyway.
We'll take it. We'll appreciate it.
There is a concept in antitrust and in the Constitution, the Interstate Commerce Clause, which essentially says that states can't make rules that overly regulate interstate commerce. And I think there's an important distinction here, which is that what California is doing is not, in fact, regulating interstate commerce, but deregulating it. It's saying Californians have a right to certain activity, and that what the NCAA does, which is that it restricts commerce, is not legal in California. And an example would be California has a higher minimum wage than the national minimum wage as well, and that's not seen as restricting commerce. And so that's the difference here, is that by liberalizing or loosening the rules, as crafted, the law should survive that sort of challenge. But with all litigation, the NCAA can sue, it'll go to court, and we'll find out.
What about at the federal level? I mean, is the concern you mentioned, California is in many ways, as we've covered on this show, an outlier when it comes to its policies. But California is a massive economy and could set the tone for how other states react to this. Andy, do you see that happening?
Yes, I think there have been efforts in other states. I testified in both Washington State and in North Carolina. Neither of those happened for different reasons. Washington, because it felt it was too small to act alone, and North Carolina, because the schools essentially co-opted the legislative process. But with California doing this, and with the three-year grace period that's built into the law, there's room for other states to get on board and essentially draft in the wake of California's economic heft. On the federal level, it's been actually quite encouraging. This ought to be a bipartisan issue. As long as you believe that athletes are American citizens with rights, then if you're a Republican, one of those rights should be the right to be a full participant in a free enterprise system. And thankfully, at least one Republican in North Carolina, Representative Mark Walker, has recognized that. And he is pushing a bill in the U.S. Congress to essentially say the NCAA cannot restrict name, image, and likeness rights. On the Democratic side, in the Senate, Senator Chris Murphy is making a big push. He's put out several white papers and is building towards legislation, as far as I know. And this is a real change from when I started studying these issues in the 90s, where Republicans and Democrats, for different reasons, both saw the idea of athletes deserving full rights as a non-starter.
Andy Schwartz is an antitrust economist specializing in sports economics, and he consulted on California's Fair Pay to Play Act. Andy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And here with me now to weigh in on the act are Fran Fischella, an ESPN college basketball analyst and former basketball head coach at Manhattan College and St. John's University, and Joe Nocera, a columnist with Bloomberg Opinion and author of Indentured, the Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA. Really looking forward to this conversation. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
Joe, let's start with you. Before we even get into the California law, how did amateurism, the model for amateurism in the NCAA, even come about?
Well, you have to go back to the 1950s, really. A guy named Walter Byers, a young 29-year-old former sports writer, became the president of the NCAA. The big problem back then was payments under the table and so on and so forth. And he began to enforce in a very tough way no pay for the athletes. and to the point where Kentucky, of all places, was suspended for a year. And so, you know, ever since then, amateurism has been the gold standard. It's been the thing that the NCAA has always said distinguishes the college game from the professional game. And it is the NCAA's view, which I strongly disagree with, I might add, that if you were to pay the players, if you were to get rid of amateurism, that college basketball would be destroyed, that people would turn away from it, and nobody would watch it.
Fran, I want to get your thoughts on that. And before even getting into that, I mean, let's be honest, college basketball, college sports, NCAA games are a huge business. What is the argument for not paying the people who are actually playing, Fran?
Well, I'm of two minds on this, Tanzina. I have I live in this world both as formerly a coach and certainly now as a broadcaster who's on college campuses. So I definitely see that there should be an opportunity for Andy Schwartz used a key word when discussing this with you, and he said elite athletes. And I definitely think for elite college athletes, most notably recently Zion Williamson of Duke University, who was the number one pick in the NBA draft. For the elite college athletes, I think there needs to be a means that they can capitalize on their celebrity, if you will, their likeness, their images. And I think this California law certainly moves in that direction. And I also think that the NCAA, my sense is they are also recognizing this major issue. The worry I have is that we paint a broad brush of college athletics by just thinking that it's only the Duke universities and the Alabama football programs. Having been at a place like Manhattan College, I saw that most college programs operate in a deficit. And so I would worry about the idea of paying a young man at Manhattan College, or a young lady for that matter, on the basketball or volleyball teams. So I know that Joe has thoroughly vetted this and he's written about it. I am of the opinion that there are so many things that the NCAA has started to do over the last decade or so to improve the lives of college student athletes. And can they do more? Absolutely. I think, Tanzina, one of the issues with the NCAA, and I brought this up with them, they are horrendous public relations people. They do not explain all of the things that I think going into being a student athlete at the college level.
But Fran, let me interrupt right there, because I didn't go to an elite school. I went to a state school. But when you're talking about these different schools, I mean, why should there not be payment for students depending on where they're playing? I mean, Joe, you were shaking your head, you know, about that. Like, what do you
I was shaking my head. Well, you know, the way it should work is the Manhattan Colleges of the world don't have to pay athletes. You know, it's just like you can pay them or you cannot pay them, but there's no rule against it. And actually, it would make college sports much less corrupt. I mean, we've had this big college basketball corruption scandal. Well, that's because they're sneaking money under the table. If you put that same money on the table, you have a much cleaner system. I would say, you know, there are 65 Power Five schools, as they're called, the big schools. They're going to want to pay, you know, and the West Texas States, they're not going to want to pay. And that's fine. It was not going to change the college basketball tournament. It's not going to change football. It's not going to change anything except that you're compensating the people who are doing the work. I want to say one other quick thing. Basketball and football players are the only students on campus who are recruited for the sole purpose of making money for the university. That's why they're there. That's why they get in the school. And so the idea that they should, you know, be satisfied with a scholarship when they're worth so much more and which they're making the coaches like Nick Saban $10, $11, $12 million is ridiculous.
Fran, your thoughts on that?
Let me push back, Joe, because much of the stuff that you've written about, I obviously agree with. And I do think there is this opportunity for us to change the system as it has been in place, as you mentioned, for a very long time. I would say, and I had this conversation with a major college coach last year, what the average fan doesn't know is that the young man who is not going to play in the NBA, one school told me that they spent per basketball player, is the world I operate in, They spent $150,000 last year on that young man's tuition, room, board, books, scholarship, cost of attendance, travel, equipment, medical, academic support. And so right off the bat, that's a pretty hefty, and that's a $600,000 investment in that young man over the course of 4 years. Schools can now pay for kids to come back to the university and finish after a pro career or any other kind of career. So on the one hand, I think that the scholarship is actually worth something. In many cases, these young kids get into a college that maybe they couldn't have gotten into to begin with. Now, having said that, when we're dealing in the world of the elite athlete, I definitely think there's a way for us, for those young people to be compensated. There's no question. But where I have a problem with the NCAA is they've done such a poor job of explaining to the sports community what it is exactly that these young people get. And by the way,
why do you get to decide that $150,000 a year is what that athlete is worth. I mean,
people have
an economic worth.
I want to get into that, Fran. I want to hear your response in just a minute, because I want to get into the who is being recruited here. Because we are talking primarily about football and basketball, and we've covered the sort of inequality that plays out in sports, particularly increasingly pay-to-play sports across the country at all levels. And often these kids are young Black men who aren't coming from elite backgrounds, who are being recruited, Fran, as you said, and coming in with scholarships, right? And I wonder, Joe, if you think that there is some sort of exploitation going on, whether that's classist or even, you know, race-based for these players. Fran, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, too. But, Joe, what do you think?
I think there's a ton of exploitation going on. First of all, you know, many of them major in eligibility. I remember Sean Battier, who was a terrific player and had a long pro career. He told me that the reason he majored in religion in college, it was the only serious subject he could take that didn't interfere with practice. He didn't really care about religion, but it was serious. So many of these players major in eligibility. They get injured and there's no medical care after they get out. Many of them don't have degrees and they have a job. 50 hours a week on their sport. And everybody else around them, all the white coaches and Black coaches and athletic directors and conference commissioners, they're making millions and millions of dollars.
Fran, what do you think about that?
You know, I think some of what Joe just said was ludicrous because, respectfully, Joe, I coached at Manhattan College. I coached at Providence College. I coached at St. John's. I coached at Ohio University, Ohio State, various levels of Division I basketball. The young man that I coached and recruited at Manhattan College, for example, a small school in the northern Bronx, probably could not have gotten into Manhattan College, and they were primarily African-American kids from the New York area. They probably, in many cases, they would not have gotten into college on their own if we were just considering academics. And we know when college admissions programs vet an application, it's not just their academic strength. It's a variety of things. Every one of those guys graduated. The vast majority of college athletics at Division I are not the Alabamas and the Dukes and the Kentuckys. It's the Boston U's. It's the Ball States. It's the Western Michigans. And it's been my experience that the opportunity to go to college, given the fact that most of those kids are never going to be professional athletes, is an incredible investment in their futures. And is there some of that majoring in eligibility going on at some powerhouse basketball and football programs? I'm sure there are. But the simple fact is, I have been part of a system that has helped educate young men who, like me, I was the first in my family to go to college, have gotten an opportunity to go to places like Providence and Ohio State and Manhattan College. And so I'm in favor of adjusting the rules for the elite athletes, but I also think the value of a college education, both in that classroom, on the court, and on the campus, is a lot more valuable than I think some people tend to make it seem like.
I just want to say quickly, you keep talking about the elite athletes, but it seems to me one way to solve the elite athlete problem, really, is to do what the California bill says.
It's name,
image, and likeness. And it doesn't always have to be. I could imagine, for instance, the car dealership in Hartford going to the Connecticut women's team and saying, we want to do an ad with you. You know, that seems perfectly plausible.
It's the Olympic model. But let's talk about that, because let's round out the segment, really coming back to what this is about, because we're talking here about endorsement rights and likeness rights and the ability for these athletes to actually make those types of deals. I mean, Joe, do you think that if athletes were paid for those endorsement rights, that would change the nature of college sports?
I don't. In fact, I think it might have one good effect, which is it might keep some of these freshmen who are jumping to the NBA after their freshman year, might keep them in college longer because they're making some money and they don't have to worry as much and they don't have to worry about feeding their families.
Fran, what about you?
Agreed. And I do like most of the aspects of the California law. And I think we'll see the Rice Commission, which, was put in place after this basketball scandal, move in that direction. I when I hear exploitive, as someone who has lived in this world for 40 years, I want to just scream at times because of all the young people I've been around who valued the opportunity to have college paid for free and have all the other ancillary benefits that come with a scholarship. And again, I can be of both minds on this. And that's how I feel about it now.
I just want to point out very quickly, when I first started writing about this 7, 8, 9 years ago, to call for players to be paid was such a minority position. People thought you were crazy. The California Assembly passed this bill 72-0.
And on that note, Joe Nocera is a columnist with Bloomberg Opinion, and Fran Fraschella is an ESPN college basketball analyst and former basketball head coach at Manhattan College and St. John's University. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.